I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. In which Maryland county is the pay gap between men and women widest? We'll hear the results of a new study on wages by gender across the state. Also today, the scramble for Barbara Mikulski's U.S. Senate seat opens up two and maybe three seats in Maryland's congressional delegation. John Fritzy of The Sun gets us up to date on all that. Kim Clark of Money Magazine has some wise advice for anyone looking for a way to pay for college. We get a history lesson about one of Baltimore's most popular and aromatic neighborhoods, Little Italy. Chris Reed reviews two amazing-looking films, and Flavio Sala returns to Studio A with his guitar. Midday Friday starts after the news. Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. It's a two-hour show, as usual. Between now and 2 o'clock, we've got a lot of ground to cover. In the second hour of Midday, we'll catch up with Baltimore Sun reporter John Fritzy, who's been tracking the candidates, declared and undeclared, for Barbara Mikulski's long-held U.S. Senate seat. There are at least two members of Congress seeking that nomination, the Democratic nomination. There's a scramble for the seats that they'll be giving up in the House of Representatives, and some news to report about a new candidate getting into one of those races. The General Assembly, well, it wrapped up its session on Monday night. Things aren't quite finished, though. A question looms. Is it going to take a special session of the legislature to settle a dispute over money between the legislature and Governor Larry Hogan? WYPR's State House reporter Chris Connolly tackles that question also in the second hour of our show today. And a treat for people who have gone to Little Italy over the years for dinner, just to hang out, watch a movie, watch a bocce game, get a slice of pizza, visit your friends, go to church. Whatever brought you to Little Italy, you'll enjoy our conversation in the second hour of our show today with Susana Rosa Molino, who's written a history of the old neighborhood, a new history of Baltimore's Little Italy. All that's coming up in the second hour of our show today. Why are men paid more than women for the same full-time work? That question's been around for years. A report released this month shows that women in Maryland are paid 85.5 cents for every dollar earned by men. Today we speak with Charlie Carter, Executive Director of Maryland Working Families, about that report, and we'll go over the math of the wage gap. We've asked UMBC President Freeman Hrabowski to speak with us for a few minutes today about the life of Dr. Levi Watkins, a wonderful man, a trailblazing cardiac surgeon at Johns Hopkins and civil rights advocate who died suddenly last Friday. And later in the hour, we're going to hear from Kim Clark of Money Magazine, who is an expert on financing a college education. If you have questions about paying for college, if that question is looming over your household, Kim will be with us in about 20 minutes. You can ask her question then, or email us a question, midday@wypr.org. We have the weekly business report coming up, too. Jen Ladd of the Baltimore Business Journal will be joining us. Up first, though, is Charlie Carter from the Maryland Working Families Group. Thanks for joining us, Charlie.
It's good to be here.
You know, this report is interesting because if you look at Maryland compared to the rest of the country in terms of the wage gap, it isn't too bad compared to the rest of the nation. 85.5 cents for women here for every dollar earned by men, when the national gap is not as good, is wider than that. It's about 78 cents, right?
Right. So we in Maryland we're making strides, but we're not far enough along.
And how does this break down statewide? It varies from county to county. I thought that was interesting, and we ought to take a look at that. And before we do, how did you go about getting this information? Where does it come from?
Well, we have worked very closely with the National Women's Law Center that's based in Washington, D.C., and they have been analyzing the latest census data and data that's released by the U.S. government every year in their wage census, wage survey that they do every fall.
Okay, so a lot of this information just comes from the Census Bureau.
Yes.
Okay. All right, let's go. If you don't mind, Charlie, I thought this was interesting. When you look at county by county, I raised that question in the beginning, which Maryland county has the widest gap?
So the widest gap is actually in St. Mary's County, and that they have 32.4 cents is women make 32.4 cents less than men to do the same work.
And when we're talking about work here, these statistics are based on year-round workers, full-time year-round workers, right?
Right, annual incomes for full-time year-round workers.
Do you have any idea what accounts for that in one particular county to be, you know, wider than the rest of the state generally?
Well, you know, what we generally see is that in areas where there are a large number of public workers, either they work for the U.S. government or the state government, or they work for a contractor of either the state or the U.S. federal government, that the wage gap is smallest in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there's a great deal of sunlight on the process of how you get paid. You are, you know, at your GS-11 or your GS-13, and there's a standard. It's really clear what the starting pay is, what the ceiling pay is, and when you get what the increment is. And so we find that where there's a lot of sunlight and people can look at it, and that there tends to be a lower gap.
Okay, well, that would explain at least in part Prince George's County.
Absolutely.
Leading the state. Can you explain that's a minus 0.26 cents.
So
what is that?
So in Prince George's County, which is really the outlier, women in Prince George's County actually earn more than men, approximately 2 cents, approximately 3 cents more than men. For every dollar that men are making, women are making $1.03.
Well, that's a real outlier because no one else comes anywhere near that.
No one else comes anywhere near that.
Right. Even Montgomery County, the gap is 17 cents.
Yes, about 17 and a half cents in Montgomery County. So I think, you know, while it's really interesting and to look at Prince George's County and say, wow, women have made it there, I think what we really need to keep in mind is that in 23 out of 24 counties, including, you know, high-income counties like Montgomery County, that there is a significant wage gap. And that actually translates into big money for women. On average, we're looking at, you know, an $8,000 difference in wages between men and women across the state. And, you know, that translates into, you know, 6 months of rent and utilities, or almost 2 years worth of health insurance payments. So that's a big disparity that we can't afford to leave on the table.
According to this Baltimore City, the gap is 10 cents between men and women. Anne Arundel County, about 17 cents. Baltimore County, about 16 cents. Let me see, Harford County, for our listeners there, about 20 cents, 19.6 cents is the difference there. In Howard County, it's wider still at 22.9 cents, the gap between men and women. And one other thing, Charlie, about this, the question looms, what do you do about it? I know that it's been 50 years or so since Congress passed the Equal Pay Act. We have an Equal Pay Act in Maryland that I think is almost, it's half as old.
25 years.
25 years? Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're closing the gap, but we're not there yet. So what do we do about this?
Well, That's why Maryland Working Families and approximately 16 other, actually 30 other groups, signed on to the Maryland Equal Pay Act this year in the legislature. And that is that we need to make some fundamental changes to the laws that are on the books. We need to close loopholes that allow employers to get away with justifying paying disparate wages for factors that have nothing to do with work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you are, you know, a cleaning person and men on the job are making more, and an employer says, well, they speak French. If French has nothing to do with the job, then that should not be a justification for why they are making more. The other thing that the Maryland Equal Pay Act proposed was protecting workers who want to talk about pay, and preventing employers from putting prohibitions on workers that prevent them from being able to talk about pay. What we learned from Lilly Ledbetter was that if you cannot talk about how much you're earning at work with your colleagues, then how will you ever know that you're not making the same amount? And pay secrecy is the number one reason that there's a pay disparity. 61% of workers across the country say that they are either outright prohibited from talking about pay with their colleagues or they're strongly discouraged. And so it's not a surprise that when you have workers who are, you know, where there's a lot of sunlight, where there's a published schedule for how much people are making, that the pay disparities would be so much smaller in those workplaces.
Right. Charlie, thank you for spending time with us on this.
Thank you for having me and for continuing to highlight this issue.
Charlie Carter, Executive Director of Maryland Working Families. You can find more information about the wage gap on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. One other fact that came out of this report: in the U.S. overall, women typically earn only 78 cents for every dollar earned by men, and some women of color fare worse. African-American women earn just 64 cents, and Latinas earn only 56 cents to every dollar earned by a white, non-Hispanic man. Let's make sure we post this report on the Facebook page, along with the posting we have already with Barbara Mikulski leading the way on this issue, as she always is. You can read more about it there. And then we'll find this report will give you a breakdown across Maryland, county by county. We welcome Freeman Hrabowski back to Midday now. Freeman Hrabowski is president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's been on our show several times. He joins us to remember today the life of pioneering cardiac surgeon and civil rights activist and wonderful man, I say, Dr. Levi Watkins of Johns Hopkins Medical, who died a week ago suddenly at the age of 70. Dr. Hrabowski, Freeman Hrabowski, thanks for being with us on the show again.
Thanks so much, Dan. Delighted to be on the show.
Yeah. I know one of the things you had in common with Dr. Watkins was Alabama.
That's exactly right. He grew up in Montgomery, and I grew up in Birmingham, and we actually are church members, but he is a wonderful man, absolutely wonderful man. I had a chance to be with him at an MLK celebration, and he introduced me when I spoke. But most important, we had a chance to mentor different people together and to talk about so many things. He was such a pioneer. I was at his other alma mater, at both of his alma maters. Yesterday, I spoke at Vanderbilt. He was the first black to complete medical school at Vanderbilt in 1970. And they have a lecture in his name, but I was there to speak, and there was an exhibit where he was to be yesterday on black surgeons, and so they were honoring him yesterday in Nashville. He was a graduate of Tennessee State and Vanderbilt.
Dr. Watkins went on from there to become the first black chief resident in cardiac surgery at Hopkins Hospital, and a lot of us really got to know him. He came to fame when in 1980, he put an automatic defibrillator in a human heart. And at the time, he had other things going on, too. This was a busy man, a gregarious man, who made lots of friends and contacts and was working behind the scenes greatly to diversify the medical staff and the student ranks at Hopkins.
That's exactly right. When you think about a man who could be involved in both amazing discoveries and that idea of a defibrillator in a human heart, and later on going up to Harvard Medical and being involved in cardiac research, and then later on being a pioneer with others in open heart surgical techniques, and at the same time being involved in civil rights and in the mentoring. I was always so impressed with his interest in working with others there at Hopkins and diversifying the workforce there, and in having this common touch of working with people at all levels. And when I was there, people of all types, of all races, there in the Hopkins system, we had to give him a hug and talk to him, and he was so Southern. He remained very comfortably Southern in his accent, in his language, in the way he approached people. It was just a lovely, lovely man with such a decent approach to working with others in humanity.
Well, he certainly touched many lives, and a lot of people finally remember Levi Watkins, who left us too early at the age of 70 last Friday.
And with such legacy, I was yesterday the chair of neurosurgery at Vanderbilt is a wonderful person who graduated from UMBC, went through Hopkins, and he said to me yesterday, what a wonderful mentor Levi Watkins had been to him. Reed Thompson is the chair of neurosurgery. And then Dr. Selwyn Vickers, who's over the medical school at University of Alabama, Birmingham, is one of his mentees who came up to Alabama the same year I did from Huntsville in 1977 and went through. And it was because of Levi that I said to Selwyn's parents, I said, he's going to be okay. Hopkins is bringing in these blacks, and they're showing this commitment to diversity. And Selwyn went through undergrad and Hopkins Med, and he's now over the health sciences at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. So Levi's legacy and, quite frankly, the support that Hopkins gave to him, both those things are major American stories that we can learn a great deal from as we think about the future. And Levi would want it just that way.
President Hrabowski, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan.
Freeman Hrabowski, president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, remembering Dr. Levi Watkins. We have to take a short break here on Midday Friday. When we come back, we'll hear from Kim Clark of Money Magazine on paying for college. If you have a question about financial aid, give us a call. It's that time of year for high school seniors and their parents or anybody who's going to college these days. So it's 410-662-8780 if you have a question about financial aid for the expert, Kim Clark. We're very lucky to have her on the show today from Money Magazine. And a little while, we'll catch up with Jen Ladd of the Baltimore Business Journal, who catches us up on a big marketing win for Baltimore-based Under Armour from last weekend. So please stay with us. Hey, welcome back to Midday. I love the headlines on Kim Clark's stories in Money Magazine, Money.com. For instance, 7 legal ways to squeeze more college aid from the FAFSA. 5 ways to get free college education even if, when, Obama's plan dies on community colleges. 4 ways to spend one less semester in college and save. And the latest one doesn't have a number in it, but I like the headline, How to Land More Money to Pay for College. That's one of Kim's pieces just from March. You can find links to these stories on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Kim Clark, it's great to have you back on the show again.
Oh, great. I'm sorry I'm not in the studio.
That's okay. We can spend a few minutes with Kim. And as I said before the break, if you have questions about financial aid, we put this out here right now because we know there are high school seniors, for instance, who are making final decisions about where to go to college. And part of that decision is based on what kind of financial aid they're going to get or not get. And parents are dealing with these questions. So we thought this would be a good time to do a little advice segment here on Midday. And for people who go to community college, people who are going back to college, graduate school, if you have any questions at all. So, Kim, I'll give the phone numbers again. It's 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And you can reach us by email. I already have an email here somewhere for you to read for you. midday@wypr.org.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that for anybody who has a senior in high school right now and they have more than one college, their kid has more than one college to choose from, the next 13 days are among the most crucial in your life because May 1st is the day nationally that you're supposed to pick a school. You know, you have to send your deposit in by May 1st. And you know, anybody knows that if you go into the car lot and you tell them you already want to buy the car, right, you've lost all your negotiating power. So if you haven't sent in your – don't send in your deposit yet if you want to negotiate more aid. It's only when they think that you might walk that they – that the schools might, and I'm not promising that they will, but they might at least, you know, increase your aid to try to get you to commit to that school.
You know, this is probably a hard question for you to answer because it's a hard thing to measure. How many students just decide, I want to go to this college and we're going to make it work no matter what, rather than mom and dad saying, well, you're going to go to this college because this one's giving you a better deal than another, and that's all we can afford this year.
Oh, well, first of all, the numbers on that have changed dramatically. It used to be, you know, parents used to say to a kid, you know, whatever you get in, we'll pay, because it wasn't that expensive, right?
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, all the surveys are showing that the cost of a college is now either, you know, almost the number one deciding factor in choosing what college the students are going to go to, and that parents are really starting to put their foot down in terms of these, you know, $60,000-$65,000 colleges. You know, I mean, some of these schools are now approaching $70,000 if you don't get any aid.
Okay, so that has been measured. There has been a survey on that. Okay,
a lot of surveys, and you know, it's rational, right? You know, I mean, parents just can't say, you know, I can afford $280,000 or whatever, you know, to send you to this expensive private school.
Hey, I mentioned community colleges there for a moment, and the other day when Goldie Blumenstick was on the air from the Chronicle of Higher Education, we talked about community colleges too. So I wanted to ask you this. She didn't seem to think that Congress was going to approve the president's free community college plan. I guess that's why you have that headline, Five Ways to Get Free College Education, Even If or When Obama's Plan Dies.
Right.
So you're not expecting to see that happen, I guess.
No.
Okay.
I'm not. I mean, you know, let's face it, nothing's getting through Congress, right? I mean, and if it, you know, if Obama wants it, Congress is not going to give it to them, right? Give it to them. But I do want to say that, you know, community college is quite affordable, and if you're from a low-income family, you're going to get probably several thousand dollars, up to $5,500 or so, in a Pell Grant. So your tuition is pretty much paid for with the federal grant. So it's, you know, for the low-income families, it's almost free tuition-wise. Now, the issue is that you still have to have living expenses while you're going to school, and for a lot of people that really adds up, especially if you're not living with your family anymore. You know, you have to pay rent, and you have to have insurance on your car, and that all, you know, living expenses are really high now.
410-662-8780. Again, our phone number if you have a question for Kim Clark about financing a college education. Here's a question that came in by email from Chad, who says, I'm about to graduate this May from Lancaster Bible College. I was wondering if there are scholarships available for after you graduate to help pay down the loans. I have $15,000 in student loans. I was able to get some scholarships along the way, but not enough to pay for it all. Is there hope to continue getting scholarships after I graduate to pay down my loans?
No, I mean, he's asking for free money. But, you know, I said that flippantly, but actually, he should sign up. Everyone who is graduating from college or leaving college, dropping out with student loans, you should go to the Department of Education's website and sign up for income-based repayment. So if he's, you know, in the ministry and he has a very low income, his payments will be adjusted to his income, and if his income is low enough, his payment will be zero, okay? And if he's in a public service job, like he works for a church or a nonprofit, after 10 years, he'll have to provide his income data every year, but after 10 years, his entire loan can be forgiven. Now, this only applies to federal student loans, you know, these private loans that you borrow from a bank or from a credit union. This, of course, does not apply. But if you stick with the federal loans and you sign up for income-based repayment, you won't go broke paying back your student loans. It's a great, great new development.
All right, let's take a call for Kim. This is David in Towson with a question. Go right ahead. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay? It sounded like it just broke up.
No, you're fine, David.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question. My daughter is going to be going to graduate school, so I was wondering if there's any different approach towards getting aid for graduate students as opposed to undergrad.
Yeah, there's a huge difference. Most graduate programs offer very little aid because all the research shows that most graduate degrees pay off so much in terms of higher wages that the schools feel that you should borrow because you'll be able to make it back. I mean, obviously, this is nobody makes money back on a social work degree, right? But, I mean, generally, that's the feeling, especially for MBAs or other professional programs. So there is very little need-based aid. There are some programs where if your daughter or any graduate student has a special skill, the school might, you know, have them be a TA or a research assistant, and you'll trade that for either money or free tuition. So you might check and see if you can get some sort of assistantship. But there is much less aid available for a graduate program than there is for undergraduate.
A question from Barbara in Annapolis. Wait a minute, before I do that. So the same types of aid is available for graduate school. or not?
No.
No, you're saying no, there's nothing.
There is much less aid available
much
for
less.
Graduate programs than undergraduate.
Okay, there isn't a government program, that's what I meant.
Right. I mean, there are for some science-based programs, you know, you can get these assistantships and research assistantships, some federal programs, especially if you're studying for a PhD in a very high-demand area like, medicine or something like that.
Okay, so if you need to finance graduate school, you have to do this through
a private loan.
Unless
you can get your college to give you, a lot of people work as teaching assistants.
Right.
Yeah, but that's a lot of work. Yep. I mean, you have to teach a class or you have to grade a lot of papers. I mean, you're working for the money. But.
Okay. What is the best way to negotiate for lower tuition? This is a good one. This is from Barbara in Annapolis. Would it help to contact the director of the particular college department? Do they have any pull with the financial aid department?
Yeah, okay, this is great because you have 13 days left to negotiate with you. If you have a high school senior, you have 13 days left. Do not send in your deposit until you have agreed upon a price, right? So if it's just like any other negotiation. If you have an alternative, I mean, the school is going to say, if this is the only school your kid is applied to or gotten into, then you can ask, but there's no reason why they would give you more aid except being nice, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you do have a good reason, like, hey, this other school said that our net price would be X, can you help us achieve something close to this, because if you're our number one choice, we'll commit right away, then you might get something. If the school you feel has not adequately evaluated your true financial situation and expects you to pay more than you think you can really afford, then even if you don't have another choice, you should write a letter to the financial aid office and explain, really you're expecting us to pay, $20,000, but we had a lot of medical bills, or, I lost my job, or we had a pay cut, or, we had a fire in the backyard, or whatever. if you have a legitimate reason why you can't afford what they think you can afford, the schools will typically reevaluate. But you have to have a legitimate reason. A reason is not like we're going to pay for another kid's expensive wedding. I mean, I've heard schools, say that, that's not a good reason, right? Or we're planning a family vacation. That's not a good reason.
A question about one of the stories that I mentioned at the outset with you, Kim, in this segment of the show. 4 ways to spend one less semester in college and save. I remember when you were here before, we talked a little bit about that. So is that something more people are planning on doing, as they approach college or as they get into college?
Yeah, so the problem has been that, what do we talk about? We talk about a 4-year degree, a 4-year college. But the reality is these days, the average student takes 4.5 years, and a lot of schools it's 5 years. And sometimes it's because the student cannot get the courses they want or they need to finish their major. Sometimes it's because the student as a junior, decides, I don't want to major in, engineering. I want to major in history. And so they have to go back and take all these other pre-requirements, right? So that delays their completion. So if one way to just keep on the 4-year plan, which saves you at least a semester's worth of tuition and living costs, is to make sure that you are in the major that you want to be in, right? Which means really testing it out as a freshman and as a sophomore. And secondly, choosing a college where you're not going to be it's not overcrowded, and you're going to be able to get the classes that you want.
Okay. Anything else there?
Well, I guess, I really believe in this whole idea of, taking the summers. If you need to take extra classes, take it over the summer, take an online course, just to make sure you get these requirements out of the way so that, it's not just one class that's preventing you from finishing on time.
What are the key things to remember then for parents or the students themselves, anybody who's planning on going to college in the fall right now, between now and May 1st?
If you have a choice, you really need to sit down and compare the true net cost of each college. If you're attending, let's say, Johns Hopkins or something, and they give you a $10,000 scholarship, your cost is still going to be $40,000 or $50,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your other choice is University of Maryland at College Park, and they don't give you a penny, it's still cheaper to attend Maryland, even if you don't get a penny in financial aid, than if you get a small scholarship from an expensive private school. So just the bragging rights of getting a small scholarship from an expensive school are nice, but what you really have to look at the net price to you for the college. And don't consider loans. I mean, a lot of schools will package in these parent loans and say, hey, you know, your out-of-pocket cost is, you know, X. Well, that's not true, because you're going to have to pay that parent loan back. So only when you calculate the net price, only subtract out the grants and scholarships you're getting.
Kim, thanks very much.
You bet.
Yep, Kim Clark from Money Magazine. You can find more information on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, a couple of other stories that Kim has written with advice on financing a college education. We'll take another break here on Midday Friday. When we come back, Jen Ladd will be joining us, associate editor of the Baltimore Business Journal, to talk about a couple of interesting stories, one involving Under Armour this week, another involving rodent infestation in the city jail kitchens in a dispute over a contract, and also expansion plans for the University of Baltimore. Also, Chris Reed, Midday film critic, reviews a couple of really great-looking, amazing-looking films, one a documentary, both of them opening at the Charles, and Italian guitarist Flavio Sala. Remember, he was on our show a couple of weeks ago? He'll be back to play us some tunes. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. Time for our weekly business report. Our visitor from the Baltimore Journal this week is Jen Ladd, associate editor at the BBJ. Jen, nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Every week at this time, we catch up on a little bit of the business news from our community. I thought the big story of the week, maybe in business, not surprising that Under Armour is in the middle of a big new business story. Under Armour earns $33.6 million in Masters exposure through Jordan Spieth, the young winner of the Masters over last weekend. So, what, he was decked out head to toe in Under Armour stuff?
He had the hat, he had the belt, he had the shirt, he had the shoes. He was all over the place and he led the tournament the whole way through. So they calculated that it was $33.6 million worth of airtime.
In exposure for Under Armour. So they invested in him some time ago, and it turns out he's the winner of the Masters.
He was their first head-to-toe golf endorsement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they'd wasted no time getting up on their site decked out with Jordan Spieth photos and images.
Oh, sure.
And they had it up Sunday night.
Right. Okay. Another story this week. I thought this was interesting. Your colleague Sarah Gantz at the BBJ had this story about the University of Baltimore campus. I didn't think they had room to grow there, but they have some big plans to grow during the presidency of Kurt Schmoke.
Well, they're in the works for acquiring a United States Postal Service building by Penn Station, and they're going to, once they get that underway, turn it into a mixed-use center for retail as well as housing. They just have to make terms with the Postal Service to build another facility for them in East Baltimore.
Oh, is that the deal?
Right.
I wonder what was going to happen to that. It seems like a prime location.
Right.
So that's where they're looking, huh?
Right. And they're also looking to grow their endowment by $55 million to a total of $100 million by 2025, which is their 100-year anniversary.
Interesting. Now, I mentioned rodent infestation.
Yes.
How does this figure into a story? This is pretty interesting. The headline on Rick Seltz's story this week was, "Food contractor wants back into city prison buildings, denies rodent infestation." Okay, so it's a dispute between two companies who want to provide food services there? Is that it?
Well, the city just recently rebid its food contractor for the prison, and a PG County food contractor outbid the current one,
okay,
which was a Florida-based food contractor, and their bid was, I believe, $37.8 million,
mm-hmm,
which was much less than the current, and less than 4 weeks after being in the prison, they're asking for more money.
Ah.
Because they said equipment was broken, sinks and ovens and toilets were broken, and there were birds and rodents and rat droppings coming from the ceiling.
Ah, so they were blaming the previous contractor for this mess, saying, we need more money, we got to clean this up.
Yes, and the previous contractor has come back and said that these are false allegations and they could be doing this for a lot less still.
So do we have any evidence, whether it's true or not, about rodent infestation?
Well, the Secretary of Correctional Services hasn't personally visited the kitchen, but that was promised in the next few days.
What else you got for us this week in business news?
In the print edition itself.
Yeah, this is Friday, so this is the BBJ day.
This is BBJ day. In the print edition, I talked to the owners of the Charmery, the Hamden Ice Cream Parlor, about the economics of an ice cream shop. Jay Brody, the former...
Excuse me. Can I ask you about the economics of an ice cream shop?
Sure.
That's interesting.
Well,
I assume that since things are getting warmer, people are consuming more ice cream, and during this long winter that we just had, maybe people weren't consuming as much. Is that a logical conclusion?
Sure, yeah. Oh, all right. I talked to them about how they weathered their slow season. But also, they said, I mean, the Charmery comes up with crazy flavors. They have, you know, they have Old Bay caramel, but they also have cold pizza ice cream and Saturday morning cartoons with Lucky Charms marshmallows. And I talked to them about... how they make it work during the winter time. They only shut down for 3 weeks in January, and they do that by themselves at their own option.
Oh, they say this is when we should take vacation.
That's when they take vacation, okay. Exactly.
And that's your story in the print edition today?
In the print edition
I'm
today.
Sorry, what was the other stories you want?
Jay Brody has a great opinion piece about the Port of Baltimore and how double stacking is really necessary for it to become the player that it should be in the future.
Double stacking of... cargo,
yes.
Double stacking on trains,
yes.
Which means we need to do things with our infrastructure to make this possible.
Oh, yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, I got that.
And we also have a look at CFOs in Baltimore, including the CFOs of Planned Parenthood of Maryland, Goodwill Industries of the Chesapeake, and Johns Hopkins Medicine.
Those people who are good with numbers, you mean?
Yes.
Those people who are good with numbers.
Turns out they're very important.
They are. You're not kidding. Jen Ladd is Associate Editor of the Baltimore Business Journal, BBJ.com. No, no, it's Baltimore.
BusinessJournal.com.
As simple as that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jen. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
And now we turn to Chris Reed, Midday Film Critic. Nice to have you on the show again, Chris.
Great to be back, Dan.
Chris is chair of the film department at Film and Video Department at Stevenson University and joins us once a month with Linda DeLibero for Midday on Film. But every once in a while, we got to review the current cinema. And I'm just learning about these two films that you're going to tell us about today. But they look, I said they look amazing. I just said it. The teasers look amazing. Am I being fooled by teasers or...
No, for the most part, it's...
trailers, I mean.
You're absolutely right to think that both of these films are amazing in their own unique ways. So we've got two films opening at the Charles. One is Assault of the Earth, co-directed by Wim Wenders, who people probably know from Buena Vista Social Club, Wings of Desire, Paris, Texas. And it's a documentary about the Brazilian photographer Sebastião Salgado. The other film, which I'll talk about in a moment, is White God, a Hungarian film starring over 250 rescue dogs and assorted much fewer humans.
This photographer.
This is an amazing film about Sebastião Salgado, about whom I knew very little. And the film won at the Cannes Film Festival last year something called the Un Certain Regard Award, which is given to films kind of are a little bit experimental in their approach, and it was also nominated for Best Documentary Feature this past year, even though it hasn't yet been released in film festivals. And what it is it's a portrait of Salgado and his work. Now, he's a photographer who has changed the focus of his work over the years. He was trained as an economist, and he's always highlighted important social issues in his photography, poverty, violence, and then in the 90s, genocide through his really brutal photographs of the Rwandan genocide, which we see in the film and are just so incredibly affecting and moving to behold. And so the film dives into this work, showing us his photographs and showing us the photographer, who speaks mostly in French because that's the language that he and Wenders share. So obviously the film is subtitled. And we learn about him. We see his work. So often Wenders sort of separates his head, as opposed to the usual talking head interview, he sort of puts his head in the middle of his photographs, sort of emerging as a mysterious deity narrating the work that he's produced over these years. And so it's really a brilliant film, and he co-directed the movie with Salgado's son, who's also a filmmaker. It's a work of incredible passion, a work of devotion about an artist who is devoted to the photographs that he creates.
The visuals look just mind-blowing.
They're stunning.
Okay, so is it possible for you to have a clip of
yes,
this?
There is, because we hear here the director.
Who, all right, it's French, and it's visually amazing, and we're on radio, so.
But Wim Wenders does narrate a little bit of the film in English.
Okay.
He'll sound to our viewers who remember our Werner Herzog show a little bit like Werner Herzog, because they're both German. And, of course, he shares with Werner Herzog this constant back and forth between making fiction and documentary films. And here he is early in the film discussing how he came to become obsessed with Salgado while we are looking at a photograph of a woman with these sort of arresting eyes.
I first saw this picture here in a gallery more than 20 years ago. I had no idea who took it. Whoever it was had to be both a great photographer and an adventurer, I thought. There was a stamp on the back and a signature, Sebastião Salgado. I acquired the print. The gallerist pulled other pictures by the same photographer from a drawer. What I saw profoundly moved me, especially this image here, a portrait of a blind Tuareg woman. It still moves me to tears, even if I see it every day, as it's hanging over my desk ever since. So one thing I knew already about this Sebastião Salgado, he really cared about people. That meant a lot in my book. After all, people are the salt of the earth.
Le sel de la terre.
The salt of the earth. Le sel de la terre. And you can hear the meditative quality of the film there with the music acting in perfect counterpoint to the narration. And, of course, the visuals are stunning.
I got to see this.
I highly recommend it. Go see it at the Charles this weekend.
So I wasn't sucked in by the trailer. I mean, it did look mind-blowing to me, the visuals in this. Okay, so now we get to the dog movie.
Yes,
so,
we do.
So you get people's attention when you say it's a dog movie. But this, what a plot this is. This is a Hungarian film called White God.
White God, exactly, which makes reference to the sort of European history of colonization and sort of putting themselves up above people of color, or in the case of the Spanish conquistadors being mistaken for deities as they invaded South America. So it's a play on that. It's a play on Sam Peckinpah's White Dog, and it's a parable of slave uprisings, except in this case, the animals... The slaves are animals, and of course we've recently had the Planet of the Apes reboot, so this kind of idea of animals rising up against their human masters is a parable for human rebellion against authoritarian rule is nothing new, but it's fascinating to watch it done with live dogs. So the director...
I had to ask you a question. Yes. Yeah. Live dogs.
That's right.
So I saw one visual from this, a photograph, that looked like 200 and something dogs chasing a boy on a motor scooter or something, right?
It's a young girl.
It's a girl.
13-year-old Lily, who's the protagonist.
Okay.
Well, there are two protagonists. There's Lily and then her dog, Hagen. So, yes, you are right.
I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, that's got to be computer generated.
No, it's not. And that is the most amazing aspect of the film. I think the parable, to be honest, is a little bit obvious. And certainly we've seen it done before. But we haven't seen it done in this way. And it is fascinating to see how this Hungarian director has taken over 250 actual rescue dogs and trained them first in small groups so that they would, not be difficult to learn behavior, and then put them together in this massive, massive scene that opens the film that looks like a post-apocalyptic zombie film because the streets are deserted. It's Budapest, which, of course, brings up echoes of the 1956 uprising against Soviet totalitarian rule. And here's this young girl on a bike, and all of a sudden, around a corner comes a horde of dogs.
Can I just say, we posted this photograph from the film, a still on my Facebook page. So go look at that and tell me you don't think this is a CG, and you're saying they actually got all these dogs
to do
this.
They did. And they got homes for all the dogs at the end of the film. It's an important point that the director makes, is that he made sure, his name is Kondrel Modrescu, that he found homes for all of them. The lead dog is actually played by two brothers, Luke and Bodhi, who are from Arizona, and they were specially trained more than the other dogs. And this is probably one of the finest canine performances I've seen on the screen, the two brothers acting as one dog. There's, of course, also a scene stealing Jack Russell, but Jack Russell's always
steal
a scene. I didn't love every aspect of the film. As I said, the metaphor of the slave uprising, once we get it, it is a rather obvious one, but it is so brilliantly staged that I think it's worth watching. And of course, there's a huge disclaimer at the opening of the film saying no animals were harmed in the making of the film. And boy, does this film require that kind of big title at the beginning, because people are going to wonder. There's dog fighting. Lily loses her dog in the beginning of the film. Her father lets him go in the streets of Budapest, and he ends up being captured by dog fighters, and we see that horrible process before he leads a rebellion against the human oppressors. So it's important to know from the get-go that no animals were harmed in the making of the film.
That's amazing. I got to see this just to see this. Even if the parable is obvious, I don't care. I need to see how they managed to do that. It's called White Dog. It's in Hungarian.
White God.
What did I say?
White Dog, which is a Sam Peckinpah film. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, because it's a
white
real...
White Dog is God backwards.
No, of course, so, yeah. Well, I always say dog is my co-pilot, so you know.
Okay. That's it, the Charles, and so is Le Sel de la Terre, yes, the Salt of the Earth.
Indeed.
Wow, sounds like a great double feature to me.
Yeah.
Too bad it's going to be 80 degrees tomorrow. But anyway, thank you very much, Chris.
Sure.
All right, Chris Reed is one of our film critics here on Midday. The two films, again, he talked about, Salt of the Earth and this other one, the dog movie. Sounds amazing to me. From 2014, finally getting here on the screen.
Indeed, yeah.
White God. Now, I want to welcome back to the show Flavio Sala. Flavio, nice
Hello.
To see you again.
Yeah.
Chris, remember when Flavio was here a couple
Just
weeks
two
ago?
2 weeks ago for Marlon Brando.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Flavio's brought his guitar, and he's going to play for us a little bit at the end here of our first hour, and then he's going to stick around for the second hour of our show. So nice to see you again, Flavio.
I'm happy to be here again.
One of the things I was going to mention
like
is, yeah, this is your third visit with us. And we always hear nice things from our audience when you get here. So one thing I wanted to tell everybody about is this live online concert that
yes.
you're giving on Sunday.
On Sunday, 3 p.m. from yeah. my home.
Yeah, I know. Yes. Have you done this before?
Yes, just two months ago, I had one concert online because I wanted to try. So I wanted to see how I feel, and it was really great, and people got crazy about that. Maybe many people think about that it's like watching a video on YouTube, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not like that.
It's live.
It's live. So you can interact with me because there is an open chat. So they can talk to each other, all listeners from all over the world. And they can ask me what to play. Oh, Flavio, can you play this? Oh, Flavio, this is beautiful, you know? And I'm
so you
there.
Take requests?
Yes. And it's beautiful, really.
In the next hour of the show, we're going to be talking about Little Italy in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with Susanna Rosa Molino. She's here. She wrote this book, A History of That Neighborhood.
So beautiful.
I want you to lean towards your Italian side a little
yes.
bit in the next hour of the show.
And, you know,
okay?
I just had the concert in Little Italy.
Did you?
You
were
at Germano's.
Yeah, Germano's,
and it was great.
Well, Flavio's going to play a little bit for us now here at the end of the show, and I'll tell you again, we're talking some politics in the next hour ahead with John Fritzi of the Baltimore Sun. And also Chris Connolly from WYPR. And then Susanna Molino will be here. We'll talk about Little Italy. So go right ahead and play for us, Flavio.
Oh,
whatever
yeah.
you like now. Take us into the break. So we'll listen to Flavio. And we're going to take a break for pizza today. Joe Squared Pizza is brought to us every Friday. So he provides guests with pizza, 4 or 5 pizzas, lots of pizza. Joe Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood. At the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Enjoy Flavio's music. Please stick around for the second hour of our show. We have the news from NPR, and then the second hour of Midday. We'll be right back.